This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
A very pleasant day to you. This is Joel Hilliker. The Pope is quite politically active. He cultivates a reputation as a peacemaker, making provocative forays into the Middle East, weighing in on political matters in countries around the world. And a lot of people applaud him for this. But it points to a role that the Roman Catholic Church has played historically that is cause for genuine concern. To start today's program, we'll get a fascinating history lesson from trumpet writer Richard Palmer explaining how much influence in international relations the Vatican has had and what Bible prophecy tells about the role it will play in future events. Is it racist to say that America has an Anglo-Saxon tradition? Leftists say absolutely yes, but this really shows terrible ignorance about America's history. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Andrew Miller giving us some fascinating history that will help inoculate you from being misled on this point. In our third segment, we'll hear an inspiring story about the power of selfless service toward our children. When we take care of them, we can have an outsized impact not only on our children, but even on the world they inhabit as they grow. This is a story from the waning years of the 19th century about one woman, not even a mother, but a nanny, who looked after a young man who was neglected by his own parents, and in doing so, had a profound impact on Western civilization. It'll be given by trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. And to conclude the program, we'll look at an important question. What sort of influence do you have on the other people in your life? But let's start with this story about the Vatican and its influence on international relations. We'll hear about this in this report from Richard Palmer.
On March 5th, the elderly Pope Francis arrived in what until recently was a war zone. Popes John Paul II and Benedict XVI have both tried to visit Iraq. Pope Francis had been trying for years, but despite the risk for his life, he was finally able to travel into what was once the heart and core of the Islamic State. Not just in Iraq, but around the world, the Pope is very active as a peacemaker. A secret letter from him to then-President Barack Obama ended America's embargo on Cuba. His officials were instrumental in a Nobel Prize-winning peace agreement in Colombia. In fact, peacemaking has been described as the Vatican's superpower. In a world full of war, injustice, and persecution, surely we need a great moral force in international relations. But the Pope working in this role should give us pause for thought. This is not the first time the Catholic Church has had a major role in international relations. For nearly 1,000 years, it was a genuine superpower that dominated the European international system. What was the result? Well, that history teaches us a powerful lesson about where this renaissance of Vatican diplomacy is leading. Now, today we take for granted that the world is and always will be divided into competing nation states. But for many philosophers in history, that was not the way that the world should be. You go back before the Enlightenment, and Western theories of world government had a common theme for about 1,000 years. In his book, The Holy Roman Empire, James Bryce described this theme as a world monarchy and a world religion. Prior to the rise of Christianity, you had a world made up of lots of different religions and lots of different local gods, and this went hand in hand with lots of different governments. But once the idea of a universal religion and the Catholic and the Christian Church spread, well, people started thinking, is it time for a universal government as well? And sure enough, a major empire rose up about the same time, uniting peoples that had been warring for many, many years, the Roman Empire. And so, many people started teaching and believing that this empire, guided by the Catholic Church, was the way the world should be. That the Holy Roman Empire was part of natural law. Like the law of gravity, this is the way that the world should work. Bryce wrote that the Holy Roman Empire was seen as an institution divine and necessary, having its foundation in the very nature and order of things. Pasadena City College philosophy professor Edward Fesser. He wrote that under this view, there is something abnormal and contrary to natural law and the supernatural order of things, that there is no longer a Holy Roman Empire. Indeed, he wrote, on this view of things, given that the natural and supernatural orders require that there be such an empire, it is not quite correct to say the Holy Roman Empire no longer exists. It is more accurate to say that it is dormant. The Catholic Church teaches that human beings have a soul and a body. And this theory of world government taught that the Catholic Church was the soul and the Holy Roman Empire was the body. These two could not be separated any more than body and soul could be separated, but they still had their own distinct role. Now, this vision of universal church and universal empire never governed the entire globe, but in Europe it formed a practical reality. You know, the church's role in regulating religious life is well known. When Henry VIII wanted a divorce, he wrote to the Pope. But the authority of the church extended even further than that. In a very real sense, Catholic canon law was international law across Europe at this period. It didn't merely concern itself with religious disputes. This one empire, religion, one religion type theory meant it wasn't up to states to negotiate disputes just through their own individual diplomacy. Instead, well, they should take any disputes up the chain to the higher power, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope. Now, in theory, in practice, this hierarchy wasn't always so always followed or even in existence. But it often was. The Encyclopedia Britannica notes that popes served as arbiters and papal legates served as peacemakers. Papal ambassadors held status above those from mere states. How far did the Pope's power extend? Well, when Spain and Portugal discovered the entire rest of the world and disputed who owned what, Pope Alexander VI drew a line on the map and said, well, you own Spain, you own one side, Portugal, you own the other. No form of international relations was beyond the Catholic Church, and in business, they also reigned supreme. The alum trade is perhaps the most notorious example of this. It's a vital material in textile dyes, and it was heavily regulated by the Catholic Church. The Pope awarded himself a monopoly on it. No one else was allowed to sell it but the papal states. When Sir Thomas More was fighting King Henry VIII's attempt to break himself and England away from the Catholic Church, he made clear that this was about much more than just a religious system. England, he said, was but one member and a small part of the Church. It could not make a particular law disagreeable with the general law of Christ's universal Catholic Church, any more than London, being one poor member in the respect of the whole realm, might make a law against Parliament, but to bind the whole realm. So England was not a sovereign state, More declared. It was part of a much larger hierarchy, and he was articulating official Catholic doctrine, and the Vatican later made him a saint. As England continued to reject the Church's authority, later Pope Pius V declared that God had made him ruler over all peoples and kingdoms to pull up and destroy, to scatter, disperse, plant and build. And he declared that Henry's daughter, Queen Elizabeth I, must be overthrown. Before the Catholic Spanish Armada was dashed on the rocks in 1588, the Pope's vision of world government was already crumbling, though. England was not the only country to embrace a new religion and a new system. Europe fractured under the Protestant Reformation. Persecutions and wars designed to put Europe back together into some kind of unified system ended up claiming an estimated 50 million lives. And so this brings us to a treaty that effectively ended the Catholic Church's formal relationship in international relations, the Peace of Westphalia. Over 100 delegates arrived in Westphalia in 1648 for a series of treaties that ended the 30 Years' War. And they established a new international system on a core principle that's basically familiar to anybody who's had an argument no one can win. Let's agree to disagree. We'll be independent states, we'll go our own separate ways, you don't interfere with me and I won't interfere with you. But this idea was completely contrary to Catholic doctrine. It rejected the principle of a Holy Roman Empire holding authority over lesser states and replaced it with a principle of legal equality between the states. The power called the Holy Roman Empire continued to exist as one of several major European powers, but not as a body with any kind of theoretical claim to overarching power. The Catholic Church's time dominating international relations was deemed a complete failure. The Pope impotently fumed against the Treaty of Westphalia, but ultimately it stood, and in time the Westphalia model became the standard for international relations around the world. Ideologically, the Protestant Reformation destroyed this Catholic theory of world government, but the Catholic Church didn't change its teachings on this until the Second Vatican Council in 1962, where it softened but did not entirely eliminate the doctrine. Professor Fesser from the Pasadena City College noted that Catholic doctrine principles still reflected in the catechism of those that informed the theory of the empire. But the Pope needed to find himself a new role. Nobody was queuing up to submit themselves to the kind of hierarchy that they had preached before. So instead, we've seen the rise of the Catholic Church as a peacemaker. One of the big milestones in this came in 1978, where Chile and Argentina seemed on the brink of war over the Beagle Channel, and Pope John Paul II stepped in and reconciled the two sides. In a world split between capitalism and communism at the time, the Pope represented an ancient institution that was aligned with neither side. And so this quickly carved out a new role for the Catholic Church as peacemaker and negotiator. The Konrad Adenauer Foundation, the think tank for German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, produced a paper in 2015 called Microstate and Superpower, the Vatican and International Politics. And it described the Vatican's role being involved in central decision-making and events of world politics for a long time, acting patiently behind the scenes, particularly since the middle of the 20th century. They talked about how this has accelerated under Pope Francis, who's not afraid to send letters to world leaders or even have senior Catholics pay secret visits on the White House. Catholic bishops met with high-ranking ayatollahs in Iran to try and pave the way for the Iran deal. He opened the way for the peace deal. In 2016, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos received the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating a peace deal with Marxist rebels from the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, something Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Parolin was heavily involved in. And the Pope has been very active in the Middle East, traveling to Israel, hosting the Palestinian Authority in Rome. The Konrad Adenauer Foundation concluded that at first glance, the Vatican is a microstate without massive resources. Be that as it may, it does have a great deal of symbolic power, not the least thanks to its partially sharing its identity with a world religion, which makes it a superpower after all, religiously, culturally, and socially. So we're seeing a revival in this role of the Catholic Church. But if we're considering the actions of a church, and whether they are right and good for the world, well, we should judge them by what the Bible says. That will tell us if this renewed role of this church will end well. Christians, after all, are those that say they follow Jesus Christ. But Christ described his church as a little flock in Luke chapter 12 and verse 32, with few followers in Matthew 7 verse 14. God said that his followers would be hated and rejected by rulers of this world. And he said that there would be many deceptive Christian churches and organizations. But in Revelation chapter 17 and in many other places, the Bible specifically describes another church, symbolized by a woman. This church is not a little persecuted flock, but a superpower that deals with the kings of the earth and wields great wealth, power, and influence. But God doesn't support this church's behavior. He condemns it. A church, he says, should choose pure faith and obedience towards him rather than intermeshing with world governments. He says that this church has committed fornication and that the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Revelation 17 describes this church riding and steering a beast power, which is symbolic of an empire. This beast has seven heads, representing seven successive resurrections of this empire. At times, this church appears dormant, but it rises up again. This organization is not God's church. Revelation 13 uses different symbolism, describing it as looking very similar or trying to appear to be Christ's church. But it's not. And this is why the period during which it dominated international relations in the Middle Ages was such a disaster. The Bible prophesies the Catholic Church will return to power once more as a peacemaker in our time. And that's exactly what we've seen in some of these recent events. In fact, the Bible says the Holy Roman Empire will rise in Europe one more time, exactly the way Catholic doctrine says that it must. The European Union has spent the last 60 years trying to form itself into this kind of Holy Roman Empire. But it cannot complete this process without the Catholic Church. In November 1965, The Plain Truth, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about one hard, stern fact that the nations of Europe must face. The crucial fact is this: the nations of Europe are utterly unable to unite themselves by their own political maneuvering, he wrote. How then can they come together and agree and unite? For years, the plain truth has said these nations are going to have to realize their inability to unite themselves politically, to choose a common political military leader that all can trust. They are going to finally face the fact that they must look to a supreme authority they can all trust. That supreme authority cannot be a politician or a general. The only possible answer is a religious leader. Watch for development suddenly to speed towards another European political and military union through religious union. Based on these Bible prophecies, Herbert W. Armstrong knew that you would have another revival of the Catholic Church's role in international relations. Bible prophecy talks about it being involved in the Middle East as well, and in peace negotiations there. They're going to play a huge role in international relations around the world. But the Vatican-led world order in the Middle Ages ended in one of Europe's most destructive conflicts in generations. The Bible tells us that this new era will be much shorter, but much more disruptive. But it also tells us this will be the last. There will be no going dormant for the Holy Roman Empire this time. It will be finished for good. The Holy Roman Empire is a counterfeit of God's rule on earth. That is one reason it's been so enduring. But God tells us that this time he will replace it with the real thing. Those theologians and philosophers that taught the world needed one ruling empire to be at peace were right, but it matters which empire. Soon the God family empire will truly bring peace to the world.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Is it racist to say that America has an Anglo-Saxon tradition? Leftists say absolutely yes, but this really shows terrible ignorance about America's history. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller giving us some fascinating history that will help inoculate you from being misled on this point.
The office of Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene announced on April 16th that Representative Greene was launching an America First caucus for congressional representatives who want to follow the values championed by President Donald Trump. But Greene scrapped these plans after receiving blowback from leaders in her own party. After Punchbowl News leaked a flyer promoting the new caucus, it became public knowledge that Representative Greene believes America is, quote, a nation with a border and a culture strengthened by a common respect for uniquely Anglo-Saxon political traditions, unquote. This sparked immediate condemnation from activists, scholars, and even other Republican politicians. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy responded to Greene's proposal in an April 16th Twitter post saying, America is built on the idea that we are all created equal and success is earned through honest, hard work. It isn't built on identity, race, or religion. The Republican Party is the party of Lincoln and the party of opportunity for all Americans, not nativist dog whistles. And Republican Conference Chair Liz Cheney wrote, Republicans believe in equal opportunity, freedom, and justice for all. We teach our children the values of tolerance, decency, and moral courage. Racism, nativism, and anti-Semitism are evil. History teaches we all have an obligation to confront and reject such malicious hate. And former House Speaker John Boehner told NBC that this America First caucus is one of the nuttiest things I've ever seen. I have no idea how this even showed up. We've been the world's giant melting pot for 250 years, and we ought to celebrate the fact that we are this giant melting pot. So in light of this criticism, is stating that America's political traditions are uniquely Anglo-Saxon, or stating that mass immigration threatens the long-term existential future of America as a unique country with a unique culture and a unique identity, actually worthy of condemnation? Is it controversial, nativist, or racist to believe that? The United States government grants legal permanent residency to about 1 million immigrants a year. The reason for limiting the quantity is to give time for the newcomers to embrace and become part of American culture. Some people think the government should admit fewer immigrants. Some people think the government should admit a little more. But it's self-evident that the only people arguing in favor of mass immigration are those who want to change America's unique political traditions, culture, and identity. Yet the mainstream media is piling on Green. Vanity Fair editors actually titled their reaction, "Republicans are basically starting a white supremacist caucus." Washington Post bosses published, "In the U.S., praise for Anglo-Saxon heritage has always been about white supremacy." And The Atlantic went with, "Anglo-Saxon is what you say when white only is too inclusive." So if you want to attract the wrath of liberals, just say something positive about Anglo-Saxon heritage. Now, only about 1 in 5 Americans claim British heritage, and almost none of them believe in Anglo-Saxon racial superiority. So why are politicians and commentators swarming this story? When most conservatives say Anglo-Saxon political traditions, they mean the traditions the Anglo-Saxon people developed and spread around the world. Traditions like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of trade, freedom of religion, rule of law, and limited government. The British author Daniel Hannan wrote in his book Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World, that it may come as a surprise to some American readers to learn that, in the eyes of many continental European commentators, they, and the British, and the Australians, and others, form part of a continuous Anglo-Saxon civilization whose chief characteristic is a commitment to free markets. Then a little later in his book, he says that Anglo-Saxon values had their genesis in the earliest Anglo-Saxon settlements in the Dark Years, violent and unchronicled. From that era came three interrelated concepts that were to transform humankind. First, the idea of personal autonomy, including contract and property rights. Second, the notion that collective decisions ought to be made by representatives who are answerable to the community as a whole. And third, the concept of the law as something more than the projection of the wishes of a ruler, as a fulcrum of inherited freedoms that bound the king just as surely as it bound the meanest subjects. So, do the liberal attack dogs tearing apart Representative Green's America First Caucus believe that your personal freedoms, your right to limit your government, and your belief that there is a higher law are nativist and racist? When you realize what many of them want to replace Anglo-Saxon political traditions with, you realize that the answer is yes. Today, 55% of human beings live in nations that at least claim to follow these principles. We take concepts like personal autonomy, property rights, representative government, and the rule of law for granted. But 4 centuries ago, these concepts were almost exclusive to the British Empire along with Scandinavia. In the book Albion Seed, 4 British Folkways in America, it documents how these values were first brought to the Western Hemisphere between the years 1620 and 1640 by roughly 20,000 Puritans who migrated from England to Massachusetts. But here is what even historians and conservatives do not understand. They love freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, the free market, freedom of religion, majority rule with minority protections, rule of law, limited government, separation of powers, checks and balances, governments through elected representatives, equality of all men, and inviolable individual rights granted by a higher power than human government. But they admit that they do not know where these principles ultimately came from. The foundation upon which these principles were established was not built in the Dark Years, violent and unchronicled. And it did not originate in the minds of Anglo-Saxon common people and their leaders. Contrary to Hannan's belief, the Angles and the Saxons did not discover these principles during the Dark Ages. Records such as the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and the Ynglinga Saga, though obviously colored with some legend, attest that 22 generations prior to the birth of King Alfred the Great, the Angles, the Saxons, the Danes, and other related peoples lived near the city of Tanis on the north shore of the Black Sea. Then they migrated to northwestern Europe during the era of the Roman Empire. And the late Herbert W. Armstrong traced the Angles and the Saxons back even further. In The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he proved the Angles and the Saxons are descended from the ancient Israelite tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. In that book, he wrote that through the rule of 19 kings and 7 successive dynasties, the 10-tribe house of Israel continued in the basic twin sins of Jeroboam, idolatry and Sabbath breaking. Several of these kings added other evil and sinful practices. But between the years 1721 and 1718 BC, God caused the house of Israel to be invaded and conquered by the kingdom of Assyria. These Israelites were removed from their farms and their cities and taken to Assyria on the southern shores of the Caspian Sea as slaves. The Assyrians, sometime before the year 604 BC, left their land north of Babylon and migrated northwest through the lands that are now Georgia, Ukraine, and Poland, and into the land that is called Germany today. Today, the descendants of those Assyrians are known to us as the German people. The people of the 10-tribed house of Israel also migrated northwest, though the Assyrians had taken Israel into captivity. The Israelites did not remain as slaves of the Assyrians in Europe. They continued on a little further into Western Europe, the Scandinavian Peninsula, and the British Isles. So the history of the United States and Britain is the history of the Angles and Saxons and related peoples. And that history traces back to ancient Israel. And far from exalting the Anglo-Saxons, this history humbles them. The precious, positive, world-changing values that they have spread across the globe came not because of them, but in spite of them. The history of America's ancient forefathers is the history of repeated rebellion, failure, and subjugation. The continued existence of the Israelites, let alone their positive influence on the world, is attributed entirely and exclusively not to Israel, but to the God of Israel. God promised great blessings to the Israelites, but in Leviticus 26, he warned them that if they sinned against him, he would delay those promises for 2,520 years. You can reference the United States and Britain in Prophecy for a detailed numerical breakdown of that prophecy. Now, King Tiglath-Pileser III carried the eastern half of the tribe of Manasseh away captive in the year 734 BC, and his successor, King Shalmaneser V, carried the other half of the tribe away, along with the entire tribe of Ephraim, in 718 BC. Count forward 2,520 years from 734 BC, and you arrive at AD 1787, the year of the development and the signing of the United States Constitution. Count forward 2,520 years from 1718 BC, and you arrive at AD 1803, the year of the history-altering Louisiana Purchase that began America's rise to becoming the greatest power in world history. This is not the history of a great or superior people. This is the history of a great and superior God. And when radical leftists attempt to blot out Anglo-Saxon political traditions through vicious political tracks, mass migration, and other means, they're not really attacking white supremacy, nor are they defending equal opportunity, liberty, and justice for all. They are attacking the Bible, and they are attacking the reality of history.
I really appreciate that, Andrew. I like how you broke that all down and just, you know, arm our listeners with the facts about American history that shows what the real source of what they're attacking is. This goes along with this prophecy that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been emphasizing a lot lately, 2 Kings 14, 26, and 27, this effort to blot out the name of Israel. And you just see this consistent effort. Anything that illuminates that history of America being Israel, America being Manasseh, anything that illuminates the godly origins of the peoples of this country is under attack, and they disregard the facts and they just brand it with this label racist to try to intimidate people.
Right, yeah. I mean, you look at that prophecy and it talks about blotting out the name of Israel from under heaven, which just means that like everywhere on earth, everywhere it can be found. And that's really one of the root causes you see behind this just obsession the Democrats and the radical left have with racism today. As like I pointed out, it's like this really no one I can think of in the Republican Party who is claiming that the white race or the Anglo-Saxon people are superior to other peoples.
Right.
They're claiming that this set of political values that the ancient Israelites and then the Anglo-Saxons that descended from them have spread from Israel to Scandinavia to Britain to America, and now pretty much almost half of humanity who've patterned some of their system of governments after America's constitution. They're trying to attack those values because you'll see that like pretty much you find all the Democrats who are obsessed with race. And again, I can't think of a single Democrat who claims that America's systematically racist and needs to get back to the values of the Constitution and all men are created equal because of it. They're saying that, no, America is systematically racist and we need to do away with these values of rule of law and separation of powers and freedom of speech and things like that, which really kind of tips their hand that they're more concerned about doing away with the law of Israel even more than they are that doing away with the people descended from Israel, but the two quests are really intrinsically linked. In order to do away with the law, you have to destroy the history and the people that brought that law to the world.
Yeah, and I think you make a powerful point about just how when you look at the history of Israel, you see this is not about white supremacy. It's not about exalting the people of Israel, because as you said, that history shows a whole lot of failure and rebellion against God, and God actually fulfilling his promises in spite of that rebellion. It really does point to God in a wonderful way, and it's very inspiring when you really look into that history. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's Anglo-Saxon traditions and why they are being unfairly attacked by leftists. He's written an article, "Are Anglo-Saxon Values Really Racist?" You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We'll hear an inspiring story about the power of selfless service toward our children. When we take care of them, we can have an outsized impact not only on our children, but even on the world they inhabit as they grow. This is a story from the waning years of the 19th century about one woman, not even a mother, but a nanny, who looked after a young man who was neglected by his own parents, and in doing so, had a profound impact on Western civilization. It'll be given by trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques.
It was a baby boy. He entered the world at 1:30 on the morning of November 30th, 1874, born to a noble family in Oxfordshire, England. As a child, he had a large table for his thousands of toy soldiers and their momentous battles. He had wonderful collections of books and stamps. He even had his own log cabin, accessed over a small moat by a functioning drawbridge. Because of the aristocratic station he was born to, he had everything a boy could ask for. Almost. This boy was Winston S. Churchill, and his parents, Randolph and Jenny, provided his physical needs and even luxuries, but they deprived him of affection, and even of time together. The late historian William Manchester wrote in his book, The Last Lion, about the way parents of this era and of this social class viewed their children. He wrote, quote, "Nurseries were rarely visited by upper-class parents. Like popes granting audiences, they received their children at appointed times when the small ones, scrubbed and suitably dressed, presented themselves for inspection, while their nannies reported on their deportment." So that was the custom at the time for parents in this social class, but for young Winston Churchill, his parents didn't even engage in these brief interactions. Randolph and Jenny were just too busy. They were completely absorbed in the whirl of high society. So the two saw very little of Winston during his earliest years. And then when he turned 7, they sent him off to his first of several boarding schools. Winston's time at these schools was often brutal because he had both a lisp and a stutter, which caused his classmates to bully him. Winston was also disliked by many of the schoolmasters, and he was even caned by a sadistic headmaster on at least one occasion until his back was just covered in welts. Throughout these difficult years, Winston was often lonely, and he frequently wrote to his father and mother, pleading for visits. Some excerpts from his letters at the time say, "Come and see me soon. Come and see me soon, dear mama. I'm wondering when you're coming to see me." But except on the rarest of occasions, neither his mother nor his father were willing to take the short train ride to see him. In fact, they rarely even replied to his letters. In one letter to his mother, 9-year-old Winston wrote, quote, "I've only had one letter from you this whole term." So it's clear that Winston didn't receive much, if any, parental affection. It was glaringly absent throughout his childhood, but that void was filled, as best it could be, by another figure. And that was the live-in caretaker who was hired when Winston was 1 month old. She was a 40-year-old woman named Elizabeth Ann Everest. Most biographies about famous people include little mention of nannies. But in biographies of Churchill, the situation is different. Manchester's The Last Lion, for example, discusses Everest in dozens of passages, and many of them are quite detailed. And that's because the early history of Winston Churchill is, in many ways, the history of Everest. For Winston's first 7 years, she was his world entire. This world was largely one of learning. Reading, writing, and basic mathematics were part of their daily routine in the nursery. But Everest also allowed time for, and even joined him, in acting out scenes from the books they read and in other kinds of recreation. When Winston was very young, he called her womb, which, with his speech troubles and just from being a young child, was apparently the closest he could get to saying woman. And this sobriquet stuck even after he grew older and more articulate. And to Winston, womb was more than an educator and a playmate. She saved him from emotional starvation. She shaped his personality. She taught him to navigate the vicissitudes of life. And Winston, neglected, bullied, and afflicted by frequent illnesses, really experienced vicissitudes. But even as he grew and his world widened, he knew that whatever struggle he faced, he could discuss it with womb. And he knew that he could receive comfort and sound counsel from her. In Churchill's autobiography titled My Early Life, he wrote, quote, "My nurse was my confidant. Mrs. Everest it was who looked after me and tended all my wants. It was to her I poured out my many troubles." At age 11, Winston contracted double pneumonia. He was violently ill for several days. After finally beginning to recover, he yearned for a visit from Everest. And a letter that his doctor wrote to Winston's parents confirms just how deeply the boy's love for womb ran. It says, quote, "Forgive my troubling you with these lines to impress upon you the absolute necessity of quiet and sleep for Winston, and that Mrs. Everest should not be allowed in the sick room today. Even the excitement of pleasure at seeing her might do him harm." The next year, Winston was living at Harrow Boarding School. His mother had not visited him there for nearly a year, and his father never had. But one day, after months of Winston beseeching his parents to send her, Mrs. Everest arrived. Manchester wrote about this, stating, Public schoolboys then were ashamed of their nannies, but Winston paraded his old nurse, immensely fat and all smiles, down High Street, and then unashamedly kissed her, in full view of his classmates. One of those schoolmates later said that kiss was one of the bravest acts he had ever seen. Viola Asquith, a personal friend to Winston Churchill during his adult years, summarized all that Womb was to him. She wrote, "In Winston's solitary childhood and unhappy school days, Mrs. Everest was his comforter, his strength and stay, his one source of unfailing human understanding. She was the fireside at which he dried his tears and warmed his heart. She was the nightlight by his bed. She was security." Correspondence between Winston and Everest provides insights not just into their profound bond, but also into the wisdom that Everest imparted to him and the character that she helped him develop. She warned him of the dangers of debt and the perils of befriending bad influences. She admonished him about the importance of maintaining health and the virtue of practicing kindness toward animals. She helped him develop concern for the poor, which Manchester said made Churchill one of the two most effective champions of the working class in Britain's political arena. Everest also taught Winston, as best she could, about his creator. He would see her praying silently and ask her about the purpose. She would explain and pray aloud for him to hear and learn. It was from her lips that Winston first heard passages of the King James Bible spoken. She helped him memorize parts of it and taught him about the lives of men and women recorded in its pages. And during the frequent walks that Womb and Winston took together, she taught him to sing many hymns. In his book, Never Give In, Stephen Mansfield describes Everest as a low church adherent who was averse to the ritual and popish trappings of the Anglican Church. But he says she was, quote, "a passionate woman of prayer, and she taught young Winston well." Thanks to Everest's influence, Churchill realized during his teen years that Britain's colonial policy was noble and worth fighting for only as long as it remained founded on what he called a higher reason and a moral force, the divine foundation of earthly power. Churchill's belief that his country represented Christian civilization was central to his lifelong sense of mission. It helped instill in him his famous, indomitable determination to stand and fight. Journalist Cal Thompson once asked, "Who put such moral steel in Churchill's heart and spine? If his parents were not strong spiritual and ethical guides, who gave Churchill such principles?" The answer is Elizabeth Ann Everest. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson wrote a biography on Churchill in 2014, and in one section he discusses all that Everest imparted to Winston, and he concludes, "She it was, I reckon, who helped him to that vast and generous moral sense." And the moral sense that Everest helped build in young Winston is not incidental. It ultimately changed the course of history. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury writes in his booklet, Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman, about this, and he says, quote, "There has probably never been a greater political watchman than Winston Churchill. His foresight saved the Western world from demise in World War II. The importance of Churchill's uncompromising stand against Nazi evil at a time when no one else was willing to confront it cannot be overstated. It truly saved the world. Mr. Fleury makes clear that it was actually God who accomplished that, but he did so through Churchill. And Churchill may never have had the foresight, conviction, and spine to be used in such a mighty way without Everest." When Winston was 19 years old, financial strain prompted his family to dismiss Everest, despite his adamant objections. She moved in with her sisters, who, along with more financial support from Winston than he could sensibly afford, kept her from utter destitution. But the following year, Winston received a letter saying she had contracted peritonitis. He dropped everything and rushed to see her. Everest knew her own condition was serious, but her worry was only over Winston, who had traveled through rain to visit her. She refused to be comforted until he dried himself off. Soon after, she slipped into a coma. The young man sat at her side, holding the hand that had dressed him, the hand that had helped him learn to walk. that had turned the pages of his storybooks, pointed to the scriptures, dried his tears, picked him up, and built his life. It was Womb, who had always been there when he was otherwise alone. Womb, who had taught him compassion and humility. Womb, who had shown him endless love. He held her hand until the end, at 2:15 the next morning. He later wrote, "Death came very easily to her. She had lived such an innocent and loving life of service to others and held such a simple faith that she had no fears at all and didn't seem to mind very much. She had been my dearest and most intimate friend during the whole of the 20 years I had lived. I shall never know such a friend again." Used by God, Winston S. Churchill changed history and our lives. And used by God, Elizabeth Ann Everest changed Winston Churchill.
Thank you, Jeremiah. It's such an inspiring story. Winston Churchill obviously gets a very well-deserved praise for what he contributed to the 20th century. Among those who are willing to look into that history honestly, I love the fact that you have this example of this woman who, as far as we know, I mean, we put this story in the new Trumpet print edition. There's one photograph of this woman that is available anywhere, as far as we can tell. She's virtually invisible as far as history is concerned. I think William Manchester did a fantastic job of culling this story out of the fragments that he was able to pull together. But the power of the sacrificial, service-oriented spirit in a woman who really gets no praise, it's quite extraordinary.
It really is, and there's a lesson there for every one of us. You know, Mr. Fleury, I mentioned him a moment ago, and he's written quite a lot about Churchill. He even wrote an article in the Royal Vision back in November of 2017 that called a lot of attention specifically to Elizabeth Everest and the importance of her influence on him. And Mr. Fleury also showed there that there's a lesson in her example for each one of us. I'll just read a little quote from that, but it says, "This woman was there to serve and help him when he needed her most. This remarkable nanny played an important part in shaping and preparing this soon-to-be great leader. Look at what this woman did for Churchill just by serving. Mm-hmm. She helped shape a magnificent leader. You could say she had a mighty impact on Western civilization just by serving this young boy. We need to be ambitious to serve and forget about the spotlight." So I think just a powerful lesson there. Many of us, you know, have opportunities to serve children or others, and we may not think that that's very important on some level, but who knows who those children that we serve may grow up to be? Who knows what they Right. might grow up to do? So I think that is a powerful lesson there.
Well, the other side of this is, and there's not too many of us in families that would be able to afford a nanny. Usually it's the mother who is in the position of working with those kids and serving those kids. And I think in society today, we tend to have more of the attitude of a Jenny Churchill and our own ambitions and don't have the time to devote to our children. But what an impact a mother can have on a child when she does just devote herself to serving her family, serving her children in that way, rather than just, you know, subcontracting that job to a daycare or something like that. When a woman is really devoted and putting the effort into those children that they need and that they deserve, she really can have a tremendous impact, not only on that child, but on the world at large as well. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Elizabeth Everest, the nanny of one of the greatest leaders of the 20th century. Jeremiah has written an article that you can find in the latest edition of the Trumpet magazine, the July 2021 edition. It's titled, "The Woman Who Saved the Man Who Saved the World." You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. These are the words of Proverbs 27 and verse 17 in the Revised Standard Version. And it's talking about a quality friendship, like two blades working together to make each other sharper. Do you have friends like that? Do your friends make you a sharper person? And do you have that same influence on them? What sort of effect do you have on your friends and on others around you? That's a tough question to ask yourself honestly, to answer honestly. What sort of influence do I have on other people? Is it positive? Is it as effective as it could be? We all need to understand that influence is really the essence of leadership. Your influence on other people is the true measure of your leadership. It's not about being put into a particular position or being given a particular title or possessing certain knowledge. Your effectiveness comes down to how much you influence others. And of course, whether that influence is for the good or the bad. I think it's very easy to underestimate just how big of a role you play in determining your surroundings, the nature of your family, your work environment, your congregation, and whether these are really positive, whether it's a character-building place to be, whether it's really successful or not. What are you contributing to others' experience in those different aspects of your life? It's really an important question to contemplate. Jesus Christ made a profound series of statements in Matthew 5. In verse 13, he said to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men." Now, salt makes food taste better. It can add a lot to a dish, and it doesn't take a whole lot. Just a little bit of salt can make quite a big difference. And Jesus Christ is saying this is the kind of effect that we should have. He wants his people to have a real positive effect on the people around them, to make things more flavorful in a positive and a constructive way. Now, there are very few of God's people in the world, and we have a big job to do, having a positive influence. But what Christ is saying is if we lose our savor, in other words, if we become just like the world around us, we serve no purpose. If you're just following the crowd, you have lost your savor. You have to break free of that. You have to get stronger. You have to recognize your purpose and then work to fulfill that purpose. In the next verse, verse 14 in Matthew 5, Christ said, "You are the light of the world." This world is very dark. It's full of darkness. And God wants his people to be a light. So that too means not just going along with the darkness. To be a light means to really stand out from your surroundings because you do things differently. Christ continues, "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it gives light unto all that are in the house." That is the purpose of a light. To fulfill that purpose, you have to be confident in what you believe. You have to be strong. We all want to earn a reputation as someone who doesn't compromise. That means you've got to stand up for what you believe. And if you do that, and you do it consistently, you will earn others' respect for that. Even if they disagree with you, they'll acknowledge that you are a person who stands for what you believe. And once you have that reputation, you'll find that other people aren't nearly as likely to try to lead you astray. You know, if you find yourself constantly targeted by negative influence from other people, you've got to ask yourself why that is. It could be very, very well that people see you as an easy target. That means you've got to get stronger. You have to think more about how to become a positive influence on other people. You've got to hold your ground and then try to radiate that light in a positive way. Verse 16, Jesus Christ says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." This is really a profound concept. Even one candle can spread a whole lot of light and can have a lot of influence on other people. I feel the older I get, the more I realize how easy it is for us to underestimate our potential for being a positive influence on other people. We really have to pay attention to recognize this and to see how God is always trying to shine a light on that potential. He's trying to build a fire within us that can be used to light up a room. He wants each one of us to glow brighter and brighter so that that light can ignite something within other people, that it can grow and spread. Again, how positive is your influence? How can you grow in positive influence? That's a question you can really think a lot about and spend a lot of time trying to answer through your deeds. God wants you to be a leader. He wants you to be a positive influence on the people around you. And that takes strength. That takes conviction and courage and initiative. You are the light of the world. God has ignited a fire in you. And every day you've got to work to fan that into a brighter and a hotter flame. If you take a candle and you light another candle, that doesn't make the first candle go out. The flame spreads. You don't lose anything by lighting someone else's flame. In fact, everything glows even brighter. And God says that if you turn others to righteousness, you're going to shine like the stars forever and ever. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. How can a man come to know himself? Never by thinking, but by doing. Try to do your duty, and you will know at once what you are worth. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.